Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Did Mike accidentally drown in a Florida lake, or was his disappearance the result of a sinister plot to kill him? The crisp pre-dawn hours of December 16, 2000 began much as they had many Saturdays for avid duck hunter Mike Williams on Lake Seminole, where he'd go to relax after a stressful work week. The Florida State grad was juggling fatherhood with a thriving real estate appraisal career. And that very evening, he and his high school sweetheart Denise planned to celebrate their 6th wedding anniversary. But Mike Williams never returned home. When an intense search of the lake's marshy waters turned up only his hunting boat and a camouflage hat, investigators reached the morbid conclusion he'd fallen overboard and drowned, his body eaten by alligators. Nearly 2 decades passed before the dark secrets hidden at Lake Seminole and elsewhere were finally revealed. Evil at Lake Seminole is a diabolical tale of betrayal, greed, and deception, and of a courageous mother who devoted her life and savings to uncovering the truth what really happened to her son. The book that we're featuring this evening is Evil at Lake Seminole, the shocking true story surrounding the disappearance of Mike Williams, with my special guest, journalist and author Stephen B. Epstein. Welcome back to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, Stephen B. Epstein.
Pleasure to be with you.
Thank you very much. Incredible story. Tell us the very interesting backstory to how you became involved in this. I recently interviewed you last year about your book, Murder on Birchleaf Drive. Tell us about the circumstances in which you first heard about this story behind Evil at Lake Seminole.
Well, I am a resident of Raleigh, North Carolina, and my first book was written about events that occurred in Raleigh, North Carolina, and a criminal case that was tried in Raleigh, North Carolina. This book was written about events that occurred in Northwest Florida, where I don't live, and I had never heard a thing about this story until August of 2019, when I was picking my son up, actually, from the locker room at his high school following an away football game. And I just so happened to turn on a podcast as I was starting to get interested in at least thinking about a topic for a new book. And I heard a podcast, a true crime podcast on this case. And I was enraptured from the very first words of the podcast and literally could do nothing else but think about what I had heard for days afterward, and pretty much knew that I just had to write this story.
Tell us about Lake Seminole and Tallahassee, Florida, and just a little bit about the area, geography.
Well,
geographical.
Sure.
Position.
So Tallahassee is located at the eastern edge of the Florida Panhandle. As most people know, it's the capital of the state of Florida. All of state government pretty much is located in Tallahassee, and Florida State University is centered in Tallahassee. Those are, in fact, the two largest employers in Tallahassee, the state of Florida and Florida State University. You got Georgia. The Georgia border is 30 miles to the north, and the Gulf of Mexico is 30 miles to the south. Now, Lake Seminole is about an hour northwest of Tallahassee, although it has become a huge hunting and fishing mecca for folks from all over Florida, especially in the Florida Panhandle. It's a reservoir that was created by damming three different rivers that pretty much flow in the northern portion of Florida, the western portion of Georgia, and just below the southeastern corner of Alabama. And it's a massive area. Its shoreline is 376 miles. And lots of outdoorsmen and outdoors women have been going there since it was created in the 1950s in order to hunt and fish, exactly what Mike Williams was doing the early morning hours of December 16th, 2000.
Now tell us a little bit, as you do, about Jerry Michael Williams, who was 31 at that time. Tell us a little bit about his occupation and the type of character he was and the kind of things that he really, really enjoyed.
Jerry Michael Williams, who went by Mike, was the younger of two siblings born to Jerry Williams and Cheryl Williams. They lived a fairly meager, modest existence. He grew up in a mobile home that was on a fairly large expanse of land, his parents believing, especially his mom, that the furnishings and appliances weren't nearly as important as the outdoors. And so Mike became an outdoorsman from an early age, hunting with a bow and arrow in his woods. There was a lake a couple of miles from his house he would bike down to, and that's where he first started duck hunting, a lake called Lake Ammonia. Florida's got zillions of lakes everywhere, and lots of folks, especially in the northwest corner of Florida, become avid hunters and fishermen. He certainly became an avid hunter from an early age. He was very, very popular as a kid. He became the president of his high school class. He went to a small Christian school called North Florida Christian School, which actually began as a segregation academy after Brown versus Board of Education. It was all white back in those days. It's since integrated. But he was very friendly. People really liked him a lot as a kid. He didn't get into Florida State, which was his dream initially. He went to Florida A&M University, or FAMU, on a track scholarship. After 1 year, he was able to get into Florida State and then graduated from Florida State and was already working for the person who became his employer named Clay Ketchum, who ran a small real estate appraisal firm in Tallahassee on Thomasville Road. And Mike eventually became his star appraiser. He was a workaholic, working 15, 16-hour days. He would have his early morning shift. He would have his night shift, and he would come home for dinner and would play with his pride and joy, Ansley, who was 19 months old at the time of his death, and then he'd go back into work. Sometimes he'd even take her, and she'd be asleep in the car seat, and he'd rock his baby with his foot while he attended to his paperwork from his appraisal work, sometimes not going home until 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. Mike was married to his high school sweetheart, Denise. She was Denise Merrill when he met her in the ninth grade. They were girlfriend and boyfriend pretty much ever since, and were married in 1994, on December 17th of 1994, 6 years almost to the day before he vanished and, as we learned later, was murdered.
Now, you talk about his real estate appraiser job with somebody that becomes a mentor and his boss, this Clay, and also about his best friend that he met, Brian Winchester, in high school. And this relationship and its continuance to the point where he and his wife, Kathy, are expecting a baby at the same time that Denise and Mike are expecting Ansley, their daughter, after Kathy and Brian's baby. Tell us a little bit more about the relationship and their trip through university and some of the things that they shared in common, especially Brian and Mike.
Well, it's actually interesting because Kathy Aldridge was a girlfriend to Mike before he became a girlfriend to Brian. Kathy had gone to school with Mike for a lot longer than Brian had. Brian and Mike met just like Brian and Denise met in the ninth grade. Both Brian and Denise had gone to a different private school up until the ninth grade, and they both started at North Florida Christian School in the ninth grade. And just as quickly as Denise became Mike's girlfriend, Brian Winchester became Mike's best friend. There were a lot of differences in upbringing between Brian Winchester and Mike Williams. Unlike the meager existence that Mike's family had, Brian Winchester grew up in fairly lavish surroundings. His father was a financial advisor. and also an insurance agent, and was very well connected with Tallahassee's upper crust. They lived in a very nice home right off of Lake McBride, one of the many, many lakes in the area. And Brian grew up not wanting for anything. And he went on nice trips with his family. They had a ski boat. He became an excellent water skier. In fact, he ultimately won several water skiing competitions. And he hunted a lot as well. And they would go on exotic hunting trips, he and his father. And eventually, Mike was invited to go on these trips, to go hunting with them, to go water skiing with them. And in fact, Marcus Winchester, Brian's dad, started looking at Mike as being another son because he was there that often. And he and his son, Brian, adored Mike so much.
You talk about Brian as well. You were talking about Brian as well and his father, Brazel, but also that, that's where Mike worked. But
he was a financial
advisor. Insurance salesman. Yeah, they were insurance salesman and financial advisor. So, what did Brian recommend to Mike in regarding insurance?
So, Brian Winchester, after he graduated from Florida State, the same time Mike graduated from Florida State and went to work for Ketchum Appraisal, Brian went to work at Winchester Financial Group, his dad's firm, and started selling insurance, most significantly life insurance. And Brian sold several policies to Mike along the way. In fact, he sold policies to many of his North Florida Christian and Florida State classmates, and that's kind of what you do when you're getting started. And so Mike's first policy was purchased through Winchester Financial Group and Brian, and several more policies all the way up until a policy that he bought for $1 million in April of 2000.
Now, this relationship is, by the time he buys this this policy for over $1 million, tell us about the relationship after Ansley is born, and what happens with Denise's job where she had worked. What happens with that employment?
Denise worked for the Florida Board of Administration, which was part of state government, and she was an accountant. And after, and she was always going to take some time off, and she did. After Ansley was born, she eventually started going back to work part-time, but not very much at all. Mike was the one who was making pretty much all of the money for the family, and Denise stayed at home. She claimed to have postpartum depression. Mike was sympathetic about that, and Mike took on many of the child-rearing responsibilities in addition to the 15 or 16 hours of work that he put in each day. By the time of his murder, he was making close to $200,000 a year. Denise was only working part-time, and yet it was Mike who was laboring many of the child-rearing responsibilities that in that situation you would have thought Denise would have been shouldering.
Tell us also one of the reasons why I thought it was odd that there was this much life insurance and it was this much life insurance. What was one of the reasons that involved his hunting hobby that affected this push for more life insurance?
Well, there were really two reasons why Mike wound up purchasing as much life insurance as he did. The first was his own father, Jerry, died as the result of a freak accident when he was only 60 years old, and really left Cheryl, Mike's mom, in the lurch. He carried very little life insurance, and it's not even enough to last Cheryl a year. Cheryl, by the way, I'll just mention as an aside, ran a babysitting or daycare service from her mobile home that she's run for over 50 years. She runs it to this day. But that didn't make very much money, and when Jerry or JJ died, it left her in a terrible financial lurch. And Mike was well aware of their financial situation all growing up, didn't want to have an adult life that was as strapped for money as his mom and dad's adult life was, and certainly didn't want his family left in a lurch the way that Cheryl was left in a lurch when her husband JJ was killed. So Mike always knew that he wanted to provide for his family, and that's why he worked so hard and made so much money. But He also knew that as a hunter and fisherman, he was exposed to circumstances that created risk, risk to his own safety. And his boss, Clay Ketchum, when he brought the subject of life insurance to Clay, when Mike did, Clay actually told him to load up on insurance, that he knew how hard it was for Mike's mom after his father passed away without leaving much in insurance. And he knew the risks that Mike was taking as a hunter and a fisherman, and he knew how important it was to Mike to be able to provide for his family. So he heard lots of voices telling him, including Brian's voice, that it was smart and wise for him to have that level of insurance to make sure his family was provided for in case something happened to him.
Now, you talked about Brian Winchester not only selling life insurance policy and financial advice. They were best friends since high school. But what is the situation in terms of their friendship, in terms of couples and that kind of socializing? What was the situation?
So by the time they were in 11th, 12th grade, they became a fearsome foursome, as I describe it in the book. Kathy and Brian and Mike and Denise were inseparable. They did everything together. They went out to nightclubs together. They went to dinner together. They were in each other's homes constantly. They even took a trip to Colorado together in the late 1990s. They were almost like a family, the four of them. They spent that much time together, and they really enjoyed being around each other. There were, however, and you may have been getting to this, but there were, however, a couple of occasions as we get into 2000 where Mike begged off participating in foursome activities, and where just the three of them wound up going to a couple of places without Mike there. And so that was changing a little bit in the year 2000, the year that Mike was ultimately killed.
Brian and Mike would have conversations, and Mike was close with Clay as well. But one of the conversations he had with Brian was about his relationship with Denise after his daughter was born. What was the situation, and what did Mike have to say to Brian about that?
To Brian, he revealed that his sex life had dried up, that Denise continued to complain of having postpartum depression and used that as an excuse not to have sex with him, and that was really bothering him. In fact, the day after Mike was killed, or the day that Mike was killed, was the eve of their wedding anniversary. They were supposed to go on a trip to the Gibson Inn in Apalachicola Bay, which is right on the Gulf of Mexico, a beautiful seaside tourist spot, where Mike was hoping they were going to basically light that flame again. And it was a really important trip to him, and he was a little bit surprised in view of how things had been that Denise had agreed to go with him on that trip. So that was going to be that Saturday, December 16th, after that duck hunting trip that he was on that morning. They were supposed to head to Apalachicola Bay and spend the evening and rekindle their relationship on the eve of their sixth wedding anniversary. Obviously, that never happened.
Mike talks to his confidant and, like I said, mentor, Clay, where he works, his boss. What does he say to him previous to this anniversary in the short period before that? What does he talk about actually doing in his marriage and some of the issues? What are those?
Mike had started noticing some things. It's clear he was grabbing a hold of some pieces of a puzzle. He didn't even know what the puzzle was, but he was grabbing hold of some pieces of the puzzle. For instance, Denise took a cash advance of $3,000 on their credit card, unbeknownst to Mike, and yet they had an agreement that they would never use more than $50 on a credit card without telling the other what it was for. And yet Denise had never told him about this. And when he confronted Denise, Denise told him it was to buy marijuana, and that she was using it in pot brownies, which was very disturbing to Mike, and he didn't quite know what to make of that. In addition, when he went to New Orleans on a trip in order to get close to reaching the highest rung of certification as an appraiser. He had to take certain seminars, and he went there. Denise had been invited by Clay Ketchum to go with Mike on that trip, and Clay Ketchum would have paid for it. And Denise said no. Mike went alone, and afterwards, Mike learned that she and Brian and Kathy had gone to Orlando to a club named Club Firestone, which was reputed to be a place where a lot of drugs were traded and used. And Mike started forming this impression that Denise was becoming a hardcore drug user. And for that reason, he was starting to think about life without Denise, that perhaps it would be better for him to move on from Denise because he wanted to protect Ansley. And he also talked with Clay about getting custody of Ansley away from Denise. Ultimately, nothing ever came from that. Clay was concerned initially, but that seemed to blow over eventually. And again, by December 16, 2000, Mike is thinking he's heading to Apalachicola Bay to the Gibson Inn to have a romantic evening on the eve of his sixth wedding anniversary with Denise. But he never made it.
Tell us about Cheryl, now her son and Mike's brother, Nick. Tell us about a little bit about the relationship and what they do ritualistically and what happens on Thursday before this on December 14th.
So Cheryl is the true matriarch of the family. I get the impression that Jerry, JJ, was more of the silent type, that Cheryl was a very strong-willed person, probably from the moment she came out of her mom's womb. And it was important for Cheryl to maintain a close connection with her boys, even as they were adults, and they ultimately created this ritual where they would get together to watch Friends, the sitcom Friends on NBC on Thursday nights. So they would typically, his older brother, Nick, would pick up Cheryl at her home. She lived just north of Tallahassee in a place called Bradfordville. And Nick would pick her up at her home in Bradfordville, which was the mobile home that Mike grew up in, and then drive her the 25 minutes or so to Mike's very nice home in a very nice subdivision, which he had purchased with his hard-earned money, and they would watch Friends together. Now, that particular Thursday evening, December the 14th, was Christmas time, so there are Christmas decorations everywhere. There's a Christmas tree up at the Centennial Oaks home that Mike owns with Denise. And, of course, Ansley is running around as a 19-month-old, and Nick and Cheryl get to the door, and Ansley squeals in delight when they get there, and they sit around, and they just start talking about the upcoming holidays, and they talk about the upcoming anniversary trip that Mike and Denise are starting to take, that are going to take that Saturday after Mike gets back from his hunting trip. They also surprise Cheryl and Nick by telling them that they're planning to have another baby. Not that Denise is pregnant, but that they're talking right about within a couple of months starting to try to have another baby. All of that happened that Thursday evening while Nick and Cheryl were in Mike and Denise's home on Centennial Oaks Circle in Tallahassee.
Who did Mike say he was going hunting with that morning?
Mike said he was going hunting with Brian that morning.
Okay, let's get to just before dawn, Saturday, December 16th. Well, maybe we'll just go before that. Take us to the hours, the early hours of the morning, for what is the official record of what happens in terms of Mike getting up and Denise staying in bed and waiting for him as he promises to be back at a certain time. Tell us about those plans and what transpired in the wee hours of the morning, officially.
Well, there are different – again, I'm going to try as best I can not to spoil all of the things that a reader has in store for them if they read through the book. So I'm going to, unfortunately, not get very specific. But I will say that right, Mike woke up that morning to go hunting. There's no question, based upon the records from Clay Ketchum's office, that Mike entered Clay Ketchum's office around 4 o'clock that morning. And he would have gone there in order to get a shotgun in order to hunt with. Mike did not keep his shotguns at home once Ansley was born. He didn't want any accident. He didn't want that in the home. So he kept them in a closet in his second floor office at Ketchum Appraisal. And we know he was there at 4 o'clock that morning. Other than that, there are really no hard and fast records of what Mike did that morning. We just know that Mike did not come home when Denise was expecting him around lunchtime, and Denise started making phone calls because she didn't know what happened and suspected something was wrong. And that included calling her father, Warren Merrill, who worked for the State Department of Transportation, and she told him, Mike's not here. We're supposed to go to the Gibson Inn, and I'm worried. And in fact, Denise's sister, Deanna, it's funny, she had three sisters. She was Denise. Her other sisters were Deanna, Darla, and Deborah. They were the four D's. Mm-hmm. And her older sister, Deanna, was the one who was going to be watching Ansley while they went to the Gibson Inn. And so she called Deanna, and she started making these phone calls saying, I don't know what's happened. And she asked her father to head out to Lake Seminole to see if he can figure out what was going on, why Mike hadn't called, and why he hadn't come back home when he was supposed to come home.
He went, her dad went with a friend named Damon Jasper that Denise had also called, and he had gone with hunting with Mike before at this prior weekend.
Yes.
So what happens in terms of this journey to, it's about an hour to go to this, where they're searching for Mike. Tell us who else arrives there.
Well, the first thing they're looking for is any sign of anything belonging to Mike. And before too long, after searching at some different landings in the area where Damon Jasper and Mike had been the prior weekend, they found Mike's Ford Bronco, his truck. And attached to the back of his truck was a boat trailer, but there was no boat on the boat trailer. They immediately called the Florida Fish Wildlife Conservation Commission, or the FWC, which has they're the ones who are the game wardens, basically, who keep law and order on the lake. And they had a check station not far from there. And before long, officers met with them, and they started trying to look around and figure out where Mike could have been. The initial thought was he was somewhere on his boat and got stranded, ran out of gas, whatever it was, and was stranded somewhere on his boat. But there was no sign of his boat, and they couldn't figure out what had happened to him or where he was. And then a torrential rainstorm came through that, in fact, spawned tornadoes in the area. So they had to call off the search for a while and weren't really able to get things going until the following morning, except for Marcus and Brian Winchester, who arrived that evening, and after everybody else had gone home to wait it out until the next morning, they went out on the water in the wee hours of that morning, December 17th, and they had headlamps on and were looking on the lake to see if they can find anything, and they eventually found Mike's small 13-foot Janoo hunting boat up against the reeds on the western shoreline of the lake. And there was no Mike in it, or no sign of Mike.
Now, the next day when this search resumes and authorities arrive, and Marcus and Brian give them the information about what they've discovered, what is the theory from these FWC officials and also from the prompting of Brian in terms of theorizing what may have happened based on his experiences?
Well, the first thing that you have to know about this particular cove at Lake Seminole, which is right at the Georgia-Florida border, literally you can look across the lake in that area and you see Georgia just to the east. And in this particular cove, there are a lot of people who think at one point it was an orchard before the dam filled the area with water. And there are a lot of trees and tree stumps that protrude through the water, or some that lie menacingly just below the surface of the water that you can't see. And if you're not very careful while you're in a boat, your boat can hit one of those underwater stumps and capsize, or at least knock the occupants out of the boat. And so as searchers were searching this area and this same thing was happening to them in their boats, the FWC officers quickly began forming this theory that Mike must have been jostled in his boat and knocked out of the boat and got in the water. And at that point, the question is, well, why didn't he get back into his boat? And that's where the waders come into play. There's an old legend that if one is in their waders and falls into the water, that the waders will fill up water with water so quickly that they will tug whoever is wearing them underneath the surface and cause them to drown. And so when Brian met with the FWC officers, they quickly started talking about this notion that Mike was probably wearing his waders. By the way, Brian told them he wasn't with him. And even though he was at one point supposed to go, he said, I was not with him. In fact, I was sleeping that morning. I was actually supposed to go hunting with my father-in-law. But he wasn't with him, he said. But that if Mike was hunting alone, there's a good possibility he was wearing these waders. And if he fell overboard, he would have drowned. And they searched his truck. They eventually found the keys or got keys for his truck. They searched his truck. No waders in the boat. So they're thinking he fell overboard in his waders. And the other thing you need to know about Stumpfield is that it is an area that is, at least in the summer months and possibly as well into the fall months, it is infested with alligators. And the working theory became that Mike not only fell overboard in his waders and drowned, but that the reason they couldn't find his body was because it had been stored in a hidden lair and ultimately consumed by the alligators in the area.
People find out early on about the history of the lake itself, and bodies, 80 of them approximately, that had fallen in the lake. What happened to those 80 bodies that did fall in that lake in various seasons?
Yeah, and so it's not clear to me if any of those bodies succumbed to this type of situation of falling overboard at Stumpfield, this particular cove, but for and was in an area that was as infested by alligators as this area was. But each one of those 80 people that drowned somewhere in this rather large lake, every single one of those bodies had been recovered prior to Mike Williams. And even after Mike Williams, there was never a body that wasn't recovered in Lake Seminole that had drowned in Lake Seminole other than Mike Williams.
Now,
and FWC officers believe that Mike's body would eventually float to the surface. And even though they had this theory that alligators may have eaten him, they were still hoping that at some point, at least parts of Mike were going to float to the surface and they would find him. And that would be particularly true as the weather turned warmer. And at that point, they suspected his body would surface and they would find him, but it never did.
Now tell us about Nick Williams, Mike's brother, and Cheryl, and they are out on a weekly outing to do her errands. Tell us what happens, and how does Cheryl get the information, and what is her initial reaction?
So this is that same Saturday morning, and it's about 11 o'clock. They're in a store looking. Cheryl's trying to buy just one more Christmas present for Angeli, and she finds this toy wagon, a red toy wagon like we all had when we were little, and she calls Denise and says, you know, I'm looking at this wagon. I just want to make sure that you're going to be okay with me getting this gift. And Denise says, that sounds like a great gift. And Cheryl says to Denise, let me talk to Mike about it too. And Denise at that point reminds her, no, Miss Cheryl, Mike has gone hunting this morning. And Cheryl then remembered that that Mike and Denise had told them that when they were there that Thursday evening watching Friends. And she doesn't think much more about it. She and Nick eventually go out to lunch. They come home. And sometime that afternoon, Cheryl goes out for a walk, as she does virtually every day. It became a ritual of hers after her husband died. She would go down to Lake Ammonia, about a two-mile walk, and then walk back. And when she gets back, Nick is in tears. And Cheryl says to him, what's wrong? And he tells her that Denise had just called and that Mike is missing. And Cheryl doesn't understand what he's talking about. What do you mean he's missing? Nick told her that Denise had said that Mike had never come home from his hunting trip, and that Denise had been expecting him for quite some time in order to go to the Gibson Inn and celebrate their anniversary, and he never came home. And Nick said, I'm going to go jump in a car right now and head up to Lake Seminole and join in and try and figure out what happened. And that's how Cheryl found out. And she was puzzled and stunned and couldn't quite understand what was going on.
When she hears about the idea that Gators had gotten her son, what conversation does she recall having with her son?
So from the earliest time that Mike had gone duck hunting and started this ritual of being out on a lake in the early morning hours, as many Florida lakes have alligators, it became a concern of hers that he was going to be harmed by an alligator. And what Mike told her was that she didn't need to worry about that because alligators are ectothermic. That means that once their bodies get cold enough, they hibernate. They don't feed anymore. And duck hunting season only happens in colder weather. And, you know, this is the middle of December, and we're in northwest Florida. We're not in Miami. We're not at South Beach. It does get cold in northwest Florida. And he told her, you don't need to worry, Mom. There's no way an alligator could harm me because during the times that I go duck hunting, it's cold enough that they're not going to be feeding. And that's what she had always believed up until December of 2000 when she started hearing this theory that Mike had been eaten by alligators, which never made any sense to her.
Right away, Clay and his wife, I believe Patty, are very concerned about everybody involved. They go see Cheryl and Nick, but they also go see Denise to see how she is. What's the difference in the two scenes in terms of their visits?
So Clay was awakened Clay and Patty were both awakened that morning of December 17th, that Sunday morning, by a phone call from one of Denise's sisters. Clay and Patty, coincidentally, had been up late the night before because they had hosted a graduation party for their daughter, Lindsay, who had just graduated from Florida State. So they basically had to come out of a deep sleep when one of Denise's sisters says to Clay that Mike is missing. And Clay said, wait, what do you mean Mike is missing? And she said, he went duck hunting yesterday, and he never came home. And within an hour, Clay and Patty throw on clothes, and they're heading the hour northwest and by the way, we haven't mentioned this, but the place where Lake Seminole's stump field is located is in Sneeds, or just north of Sneeds, Florida. So they start heading towards Sneeds in order to join in the search that is going on that first full day after the storm passes through. And they spend all day out at the lake helping try to find Mike. And after being there all day, they're all muddy from all the rain that had been through. They get back in their car, and they drive back, and they go straight to Mike's house, try and console Denise and, you know, try and come to terms with what's going on. And they arrive at the Centennial Oaks home, and what they see looks more like a painting by Norman Rockwell than a vigil for a man who is missing and is possibly gone forever. Everybody is sharply dressed. These are Denise's sisters, a husband of one of the sisters, a boyfriend, Denise's mom, Johnny was there, and it doesn't look like a vigil at all. It looks like somewhat of a Christmas party. There's cookies and punch laid out on the dining room table, and it's surreal to Clay and Patty that they're walking into this scene that doesn't match what they had just experienced at Lake Seminole. In fact, they're wondering why these same people, like them, hadn't been up at Lake Seminole trying to figure out what happened and find Mike. But that's not what they encountered, except for Denise, who came down the stairs, obviously having been in her bedroom, and her face looked like she had been crying for hours. Her eyes were, you know, baggy, mascara everywhere. She was a mess. And both Clay and Patty consoled her the best they could, but she was the one exception to the otherwise very surreal scene that was going on in that home. And then Patty noticed something as they're standing there with Denise at the bottom of the staircase. She noticed a suitcase that was at the foot of the stairs, which to her was a very hard-to-take-in indication of what had happened, that Denise and Mike were so close to heading out to this beautiful romantic place to celebrate their 6th wedding anniversary. Instead, they're now thinking that Mike is gone forever. And that suitcase became a symbol for Patty of the horror that had just occurred.
Right.
And then they go. Then Patty and Clay go to Cheryl's, 25 minutes north, up in Bradfordville, into her mobile home. Cheryl greets them warmly, and Nick is there, and Cheryl's friends are there, and it's almost like a funeral. It's the exact opposite of the scene at Denise and Mike's home that they had just been to. I mean, people are crying, they're miserable, they're in anguish, and they're trying to understand what on earth had just happened. And they're thinking, you know, Mike may be gone forever.
Tell us about Cheryl's, more about her reaction in terms of what she concluded in terms of Mike being alive or not alive. Before we talk about this event where she goes to the lake and then says she has a communication otherworldly, tell us about that.
Sure. So her initial reaction is Mike is a strong hunter, and there's no way that Mike would have died in a hunting accident. He's too good a hunter. He's too smart. He's too shrewd. He's too battle-tested. He's been hunting since he was a little boy. And that his survival skills, whatever happened to him, would have been strong enough to get somewhere, and they just needed to find him. He was going to be somewhere. He was going to be okay. They just needed to find him. Those were Cheryl's initial instincts, that they were going to find Mike, and he was going to be alive. And then you want me to talk about her going to the lake for the first time?
Absolutely.
So by the time she went to the lake for the first time, about 10 days later, she gets to the edge of the lake. There's already talk that alligators have eaten Mike. And she's standing at the lake. She closes her eyes, and she feels God is talking to her. And I can't quote it because I don't have the book in front of me right now, but essentially what she hears God saying to her is that Mike is alive. Mike was not eaten by alligators. Mike needs her to go find him. And that's what she believed God told her as she was standing at the edge of the lake on her first visit to the lake. And from that moment forward, that woman was more determined than any human being alive to get to the bottom of what had happened and to find her son, who she believed would still be alive.
We go back just a bit, just a few days, because since just after December 16th, there's a massive search underway. Tell us a little bit about the depth of this search and all those involved in terms of officially.
It was a massive search. There were dozens of people involved. There were cadaver dogs involved. It was a multi-agency search, the Florida Wildlife Commission, the Jackson County Sheriff's Department. Sneeds is in Jackson County, and so that sheriff's department was very involved. They had divers. They had helicopters. They had fixed-wing aircraft. They used lasers. They used sonar devices. Any lead, they had a lot of people in boats searching a grid pattern, and they would stick poles, PVC poles or pipes, down to probe the lake bed. And by the way, it's a fairly shallow area. There's only a few spots that are even deep enough where you couldn't stand. That's how shallow this area is. So there's not a whole lot of lake to explore in that area, and they're finding nothing. But every time they stick a pole down and they feel something, they send an underwater diver down to see if there was anything there that was felt by the pole. One of the things about this area, aside from the alligators, is that there's a lot of vegetation in the lake bed, and that rises all the way up to the surface, and it's called hydrilla. It's like these massive weeds that grow uncontrollably, and unfortunately, that really hampered the search, and it made it difficult to separate what one was feeling from being the hydrilla from something that could be Mike's body. And the other thing that really hampered this massive search was the cold weather. It got, after that storm came through, a cold front set in, and there were mornings that it was below 20 degrees. And even though this is Florida, there's ice forming on the lake. They had a chip through that ice in order to even get the boats on the lake, and divers would go down and they would come up very quickly because they were afraid they were going to get hypothermia. Their masks that they were seeing through would freeze up. They were very unwieldy, difficult conditions. But despite that, they covered that area thoroughly day after day, week after week, from December into February, and nothing promising turned up except for a camouflage hat found toward the end of December. And Brian Winchester was the one who actually was the one to bring that camouflage hat to the FWC officers. And he said, you know, I think that might be Mike's hat. And he came back the next day with a framed 5x7 photo. And lo and behold, Mike's in that photo wearing what appears to be the very same hat. So that was another discovery that was made that seemed to point to the notion that Mike had been there and that he had drowned. But that didn't lead them to finding Mike.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second to hear about our sponsor, which is Ritual. We all want to do the right thing to keep our bodies healthy in the long run. But even if we try really hard to eat kale salads and drink green smoothies, we're still most likely not getting all of the essential nutrients we need on a daily basis. Enter Ritual, the obsessively researched vitamin for women. Ritual's essentials have the nutrients most of us don't get enough of from food, all in their clean, absorbable forms. No shady additives or ingredients that could do more harm to your body than good. Two easy-to-take capsules provide 9 nutrients you need to support a strong foundation for your health. 4 months ago, Lisa, my wife, read the information about Ritual Vitamins for Women and was very impressed with the research that they put into developing their Ritual Essentials. She felt the difference soon after starting, and she continues to feel the difference Ritual makes in her daily routine. From D3 to omega-3, Ritual's Essential for Women helps fill gaps in a woman's diet. Their no nausea capsule design is gentle on an empty stomach, and there's a mint tab in every bottle to keep things fresh so you don't get that fishy aftertaste common with most omega-3s. A subscription is easy to start, and it's easy to snooze. It's only $1 a day to have all the essential nutrients your body needs delivered every month, no strings attached. Better health doesn't happen overnight, and right now Ritual is offering my listeners 10% off during your first 3 months. Fill in the gaps in your diet with Essential for Women, a small step that helps support a healthy foundation for your body. Visit ritual.com/murder to start your ritual today. That's 10% off during your first 3 months at ritual.com/murder. Now, Stephen, we were about to talk about this investigation and this massive search that really didn't wield anything except, like you say, the camouflage hat that just happened to be provided by Brian Winchester, Mike's best friend. What are the things that Cheryl did in her initiative to become involved and to have this case not go away and in the public's mind?
Well, Cheryl believed she was told by God that Mike hadn't drowned. In fact, she believed God was telling her Mike wasn't even at Lake Seminole. And she started suspecting fairly quickly that some kind of foul play had been involved. And she wanted an investigation, a criminal investigation into the circumstances. And she realized that if to the extent that they were not conducting a criminal investigation, there were important pieces of evidence that were going away and they'd never be able to get back again in order to search properly. So she pushed and she pushed and she pushed the Florida Department of Law Enforcement to start a criminal investigation. She started by just seeking some publicity, by sending a bunch of letters, and this woman can write letters like no one's business. She eventually wrote over 2,000 letters to the governor of Florida. But in the early going, she was writing letters to the local newspaper in Tallahassee, the Tallahassee Democrat, trying to get them to write a story about Mike. ultimately, she succeeded. And in August of 2001, some 8 months after Mike disappears, the Tallahassee Democrat does a story on lots of different people of local interest who are missing, and Mike is included in that story. So that's her first bit of publicity that she's able to get. And then not much happens after that until finally in early 2004, she finally gets the FDLE to sit down with her and to treat this as a suspicious missing persons case, and that's when they finally start to investigate this as a possible crime. And then they start doing a full-fledged investigation, talking with people, trying to gather material evidence and that sort of thing for years after that, with the investigation going from warm to cold, back to warm, and back to cold again.
At this time, too, the paper, the Democrat, is instrumental in keeping this story alive. And at some point, there is a new news director coming from outside that is interested in this story and, again, even takes it to different levels with coverage. Tell us who this is and when she becomes involved and why.
So it's actually Jennifer Portman is who you're talking about, and she
right.
actually started as a senior writer. By the end of the book, she has become the news director of the Tallahassee Democrat, but she's a
right.
a fairly young, enterprising, investigative reporter. She had been working for a newspaper in Missouri, I believe, before then. And she spots the other thing Cheryl did is she placed a couple of ads in the Tallahassee Democrat in 2006, in early 2006, I think it was in May of 2006, she placed a couple of ads that said, "My son is missing." And it ran about, a quarter of the page, and it described all of the things that had happened and how, there's an investigation and no one seems to know what happened. Can someone please contact the Florida Department of Law Enforcement if they know anything? And Jennifer Portman reads this ad. She had just started working at the Tallahassee Democrat, and she says, "There's a story here." And she starts interviewing, among others, Cheryl, Damon Jasper, who was part of that initial search with Warren Merrill, Denise's dad, that first day. She interviews some of the law enforcement officers who are part of the investigation, and she publishes three different articles in the Tallahassee Democrat on the eve of the sixth anniversary of Mike's disappearance in December of 2006. And that begins a tidal wave of information that the Tallahassee Democrat would publish about Mike's disappearance that would go on for years and years and years, all under the byline of Jennifer Portman. She essentially took this up as a cause almost as important to her as it was to Cheryl Williams.
Now, what is the relationship with Cheryl and Nick and her granddaughter, Ansley? And how was that and the effort that Cheryl has put into keeping this story alive, how does that affect that relationship? And how does it affect Cheryl gaining some crucial, information and also, a leverage of sorts?
Okay, so we go back to August of 2001 when Cheryl was successful in getting the Tallahassee Democrat to include a little bit of information about Mike's disappearance in that article. And on that very day, Cheryl got a call from Denise demanding that Cheryl come to Mike and Denise's home on Centennial Oaks Circle in Tallahassee. Cheryl gets there that afternoon, and Denise berates her for having put that article in the newspaper, for having given the Tallahassee Democrat information that led to that article being in the newspaper, telling her that that is unacceptable. She doesn't want to read anything about Mike in the newspaper. She doesn't want to see his picture in the newspaper. She doesn't want to ever hear about Mike again. And she threatens Cheryl that if she ever pulls another stunt like that again, she will never see Ansley again. That was the first incident where that type of threat was made. Now, it turns out Denise didn't follow through on that even though there was a fairly tense interaction and tense relationship between Denise and Cheryl and Nick, She did allow some visitation with Ansley to go on, fairly limited, typically on a Monday evening, for a couple of years, until another interaction. And this interaction occurred the day before Cheryl's birthday in January of 2005. And on that date, Cheryl and Nick were eating lunch when Nick's cell phone rang, and Denise said that Denise needed to meet with them. Cheryl, being the day before her birthday, thought, well, this is great. Denise is surprising me by bringing Ansley to me to help me celebrate my birthday. So she rushed home, made Nick rush her home, and they're getting ready for Denise to arrive and think that Ansley will be with Denise. And Denise does have somebody with her that afternoon, but it's not Ansley. Rather, it's Brian Winchester. And, oh, by the way, by this point in time, Brian Winchester and Denise Williams are an item. They have begun to date. Yeah, exactly. In fact, Cheryl had learned about that the prior summer when Nick was married because Denise asked for permission to bring Brian to the wedding as her date. And so Cheryl's known for some time that Denise and Brian are now in a dating relationship, and there's Brian standing at her doorstep at her mobile home along with Denise, no Ansley. And it's very clear that both Brian and Denise are upset. Denise sits her down at the table in the kitchen and says, look, if you won't stop this criminal investigation, then you're not going to see Ansley anymore. We love you, but we just can't have this going anymore. And Brian is kind of standing guard at the door, not taking part in the conversation. And then Nick turns to Denise and says, Denise, we want to know what you and Brian did to Mike. And at that point, Brian becomes irate. He says, let's get out of here. This isn't going anywhere. And the two of them storm out of Cheryl's mobile home, and they would never, Nick and Cheryl would never see Ansley again. That was in January of 2005.
What we forgot to mention for our audience is that about 3 months into this massive search, after this exhaustive search of a certain area and where they used poles to mark places that they had exhaustively searched, what was found in terms of at that point where they had searched, before we talk about that information and its relevance afterwards?
Sure. And it was actually 6 months. It was the summer. It was in June of 2001. There was a local fisherman there from Sneeds, and he was fishing, and out of the corner of his eye, he detected something that was floating on the surface of the water. Long story short, it turned out to be a pair of hunting waders. And he quickly got the FWC involved. The FWC did some tests on the waders, which, by the way, didn't have any bite marks from alligators. They looked for any evidence of human remains. They found none. But importantly, they showed those waders to Brian Winchester, who said, yeah, those well could have been the waders that Mike had at that time. So it seemed to be a further indication that this theory that Mike had fallen overboard and drowned in his waders was true, although clearly, you know, Mike wasn't in the waders anymore. But what happened next was Brian got a couple of his friends to head back out there on a boat a couple of days later. In that exact same spot where the waders were found, Brian wasn't there at the time, and a diver, a local diver, went down into the water to see if there was anything else there. And lo and behold, there was a hunting jacket, and inside of that hunting jacket, there was a hunting license, and it was a hunting license for Mike Williams. And also, a flashlight was found in the very same spot. And when one of the people who was part of that crew that went out on that boat turned that flashlight on, lo and behold, it worked perfectly. Some 6 months after it supposedly had been part of what Mike had on his person when he drowned in the lake. And the jacket also did not look like it had been in the lake for 6 months. Something appeared to be a little bit suspicious about the jacket and the flashlight. The waders, the fishermen who found the waders, did believe it looked like they had been in the water for a long time. However, the FWC officers who then received the waders, they didn't think so at all. They thought that the waders being found on that day was also very suspicious. So there was this what happened was is there was a suspicion among the FWC and among those who are following this story, and ultimately by Jennifer Portman when she started reporting on the story, that the waders, the hunting jacket, and the flashlight were planted. And the reason they were planted, they all believed, was because Denise had petitioned to have the courts declare Mike dead in what's called a presumptive death certificate so that she could begin collecting on his life insurance. The life insurance company would not allow her to collect on the claim for life insurance unless there was a death certificate. And the way to get the death certificate in that instance was to petition the court. And it just miraculously happened that the waders, the jacket, and the flashlight turned up literally right as Denise is petitioning the court for a presumptive death certificate.
Yeah, interesting. You talked about this case being very, very warm and then being cold, even though it looked like there was a lot of optimism there for something to happen. What is the crucial thing that happens in terms of the police narrowing and focusing on Denise and Brian again in this whole case again, before we talk about what that pressure does in terms of the relationship between Denise and Brian and then his deterioration and that contribution to this case as well?
Well, the first thing you need to know is that in December of 2005, almost 5 years to the day from when Mike disappears, Denise and Brian are standing in a public space in the Centennial Oaks subdivision in a beautiful ceremony, stating their vows to each other and becoming husband and wife. And Brian then moves in to the Centennial Oaks home that used to be Mike's home, lives in the master bedroom with Denise the way that Mike did, and assumes the parental role over Ansley as if he's Ansley's new dad. So Brian, by late 2005, is now essentially filling the role that Mike once filled. Brian and Kathy, I should say, got divorced very soon after the events surrounding Mike's disappearance at Lake Seminole. In fact, the day that Kathy left their home was September 11, 2001, the same day of the terrorist attack in New York and Washington, D.C. Their marriage ended that day, and his relationship presumably was starting with Denise sometime thereafter, and by 2004, they're public about their relationship, and in December 2005, they get married and move on with life as a happy couple from Centennial Oaks Circle, where Mike and Denise were supposedly a happy couple as well. And life goes on, things are fine, until they're not, and until their marriage starts to disintegrate. And their marriage finally hits the final point in 2012, when Denise essentially kicks Brian out of the home. And Brian goes to live in his parents' home where he grew up, where his son Stafford will come and spend half his time with him and half his time with his mom, Kathy. And Brian is in desperate straits. He wants to get Denise back, but Denise is not letting him back into her life. And this goes on for a period of years. And eventually, there's a kidnapping incident between Brian and Denise when Brian gets to his final point of desperation. And it was that kidnapping incident that led to Brian being arrested.
Now, why does he kidnap her? What is the pressure that he has upon him? And what does he think he can do and gain by this conversation, this need to speak with her? And what does he do? And what are the details that she eventually tells police?
Well, actually, initially, nobody told the police anything. And so Denise was interviewed on the day of the kidnapping incident, and she was asked directly by an FDLE agent who had been on this case for many years where she thought Mike was and where he was buried. And she told the investigating officer from the FDLE he drowned at Lake Seminole. And incredulous, the FDLE agent named Mike Devaney said, "You don't really believe that?" And she said, "Yes, I do. That's what I've always believed." So she didn't reveal anything of any help to law enforcement. She convincingly, at least to herself, told the story that she had been telling for years, which is that Mike had drowned at Lake Seminole. Brian, once he was arrested, also would not talk about anything associated with Mike Williams. The problem for him was he had just committed an armed kidnapping, and the potential sentence for armed kidnapping was life in prison. And so it got to the point where some pressure was being exerted on Brian to help law enforcement figure out what happened to Mike Williams. And eventually, again, I don't want to reveal too many details because I don't want to spoil this for readers, but eventually Brian is the linchpin to finding out more about what actually happened in December of 2000. This was the big break that the investigators had been looking for years. They always believed that if Brian and Denise finally came to a point in their relationship where they went their separate ways, that would be the moment that they would be successful in learning what really happened to Mike. And it took basically 4 years into their separation for Brian to finally snap, which led to the kidnapping incident, which led to Brian being housed in the jail and potentially having to stand trial for armed kidnapping, that led to a cascade of events that changed everybody's lives in ways that to this day are still difficult to comprehend.
Why do you think, what are the reasons why she initially didn't tell police about this? He had asked her in this altercation not to go to police. Why didn't she go to police? And when she did, who was it at, who urged her to go? And then what did she say to police in terms of expressing her fear from and the PTSD from the event?
So this was, by all accounts, an aggressive kidnapping incident where Brian was holding a gun to Denise in her vehicle, and it was a harrowing experience for her. But by the end of the incident, the two of them had calmed down. They had called Brian's father, Marcus, and arranged for a meeting with Marcus later that afternoon to try and sort through what had happened that day and how they could move forward. And when Brian left Denise that morning in August of 2016, it was his belief that she was going to go to work at Florida State, and then later that day they would get together with Brian's dad, Marcus, and try and sort through what had happened that morning. It was also Denise's intention to do exactly that. That's what Denise told him she was going to do. That's how she started driving her vehicle toward Florida State. And then, lo and behold, out of nowhere, her sister winds up, her sister Deborah, younger sister Deborah, winds up finding her driving along and pulls her into a medical office building parking lot. The reason why her sister knew something was up was because Denise started that morning, as she started most mornings, on her way to work, getting on her cell phone and calling her sister. The kidnapping incident started almost immediately after that, and so her sister never heard anything after the initial hello and thought something was wrong, which is why she was out on the roads trying to find Denise, and she did. Deborah's husband is Dave McCraney, who happens to be a uniformed Tallahassee police officer. And at some point, Dave McCraney gets on the line with Denise and tells Denise, you must report this incident. You need to go directly to the sheriff's office and report this incident. And that is how and that is why Denise went to the sheriff's office that morning to report that Brian had kidnapped her. And then ultimately there are several criminal proceedings that Denise participates in where she's basically the most important witness to the prosecution team to help make sure that Brian stays behind bars, isn't granted bail, isn't granted bond. She tells the presiding judge that she's had PTSD associated with the kidnapping incident, that she lives in fear of Brian. And ultimately she does a victim impact statement at his sentencing. His sentencing, which occurs a couple of days before the Florida Department of Law Enforcement announces that they have a big break in the case, and that their big break is that they have located the remains belonging to Mike Williams. That was, the day after the kidnapping. the sentencing that Brian was kidnapped was, I'm sorry, long interview. It was the day after Brian was sentenced for kidnapping. He was sentenced to 20 years. The next day, the FDLE has a press conference and announces that they have located Mike's remains and they have concluded that Mike Williams was murdered.
How on earth did this happen, this incredible break happen? Oh, we just understood that it wasn't exactly her choice to go to authorities, but once she does go to authorities, what was she thinking, and what was later her attorney thinking in terms of her providing all those details? I guess the attorney's in the dark with no imagination, but how on earth did the police convince her to be able to do this, that, and basically be able to try to put somebody in prison that shared that secret with her? It seems incredulous that she would not understand the danger of doing this.
Well, Denise's attorney would argue exactly that. Denise's attorney would argue that no one who shared any guilt for the murder of Mike Williams would go to law enforcement and put in prison the man who shared a secret about Mike's murder with her. And that, in fact, everything that you've just said, in her attorney's view, was the very reason why it was clear Denise knew nothing and had nothing to do with Mike's murder, because she never would have gone to law enforcement to have Brian Winchester put behind bars if he knew something about her. And he would say that whatever Brian Winchester said about her was simply out of revenge for her reporting the kidnapping incident leading to him being sentenced to 20 years in prison, and that it was all a made-up story by Brian Winchester in order to get revenge against Denise, get revenge against her for the things that happened in their marriage and her not agreeing to take him back, get revenge for a very bad divorce where she basically robbed him of his money, in Brian's view, in terms of what she was able to get out of him in the divorce, and then for reporting him to the authorities for the kidnapping incident, that Brian was able to get even by making up a story about Denise having been involved in Mike's murder.
Now, in this trial, the central star witness is obviously, she was star witness against Brian. Now, Brian is a star witness against her. That being said, if he is successful in his testimony, or there is belief that he is fairly successful, that would prompt Denise to take the stand as well. Tell us about what was promised. And just in terms of that dynamic that was set up, how crucial were the testimonies of both these people to this incredible outcome?
Well, I'm going to try very hard not to spoil anything for the reader who's now getting toward the end of the book by the time they're reading these events. And I want to leave my readers in suspense. But obviously, Brian Winchester is the most crucial witness in the case, because he's going to tell the jury exactly what happened the morning of December 16, 2000, when Mike disappeared at Lake Seminole, and he's going to tell the jury how the events transpired that led to that moment in time, and what Denise's role in that event was, and what he and Denise's relationship had been for a period of years, even prior to the conception and birth of Ansley. He wants the jury to believe that this was a conspiracy between him and Denise, and that they had conspired to murder Mike. And if the jury believes that, then there's only one person who can try and convince them otherwise, and that would be Denise. And so there would be an onus on Denise to take the witness stand in her own defense to set up the classic he said, she said, about whether Denise, in fact, had been involved in any way. And I'm not going to tell the readers who are listening to this any more than that. I'd rather them read the book and find out. I don't want to spoil the suspense of seeing how the trial unfolds. But without question, Brian Winchester was the most important witness in the trial, and he turned out to be a very, very impressive witness, both on direct examination when being examined by the prosecutor, and also on cross-examination, despite the fact that Denise had hired a pretty good attorney. That attorney was fairly tongue-tied when he was trying to cross-examine Brian many times during that cross-examination, Brian got the better of him rather than the other way around.
It's incredible, too, the appearance of Denise at this trial as well. So we'll just leave it at that, because the incredible showdown at this trial and Cheryl's reaction, the family's reactions, and the incredible evidence that Brian imparts. And in the dramatic fashion, again, one person seemingly feeling some grief and remorse, and another person completely cold and without feeling, seemingly. I want to thank you very much, Stephen, for coming on and talking about Evil at Lake Seminole, the shocking true story surrounding the disappearance of Mike Williams. Certainly is a shocking true story. For those that might want to take a look at this, do you have a website, Facebook page for this? Tell us how they might find out more about this book.
So find out about the book by going to Amazon and just searching for Evil at Lake Seminole. Fortunately, yesterday was the release, and it's already flying off the Amazon shelves, so to speak. Evil at Lake Seminole,
sure,
on Amazon. It's available in paperback. It's available in print. It's available in Audible. I'm, in fact, the narrator on the Audible edition of the book. There is also a website, evilatlakeseminole.com. That website is not a place to go if you want to read the book because, again, there are a lot of spoilers on that website, all kinds of evidence from the trial, all kinds of photographs, all kinds of information that was part of the Florida Department of Law Enforcement's files is on that website. So go to the website after you've read the book and you want to learn more, and that's evilatlakeseminole.com.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Stephen B. Epstein, for Evil at Lake Seminole. Thank you very much. Congratulations on a fantastic book, and hope to talk to you again real soon.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Good night.